You're listening to the North Carolina Reading Service, broadcasting from Raleigh, North Carolina, serving the blind and print-impaired community since 1983. This is Nancy Jones. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from the October 2024 issue of Vanity Fair magazine, which features Selena Gomez on the cover. This is Vanity Fair, Part A. Here's the editor's letter with photograph of Radhika Jones, editor-in-chief, by Mark Seliger. I have often thought how fortunate we Americans are that the robber barons of our Gilded Age, even while they amassed vast personal fortunes, nevertheless decided that part of their legacy should be philanthropic. Because industrialists like Carnegie and Rockefeller endowed libraries and schools at grand scale, it became understood that enriching oneself and one's family came with a responsibility to patronize the arts and other creative and intellectual institutions. That notion has persisted through generations, and although giving, even at a grand scale, cannot cancel out inequality, it's far better than no giving at all. Last year, at a breakfast with a handful of journalists, Melinda French Gates mentioned that she is often asked for advice on how to give. Having come up on the tidal wave of wealth creation in Silicon Valley, and then funneling that wealth on an extraordinary level into the Gates Foundation, she's a pioneer and an expert. Primed to counsel new members of the millionaire and billionaire clubs on what their legacies might look like outside the boardroom. As Keziah Weir reports, Melinda's own philanthropic work has undergone a seismic shift this year. As she left the foundation, she and her ex-husband began in 2000 to strike out on her own, doubling her efforts on lifting up women and girls. I know from my own work as a director of the Board of CARE, the global humanitarian organization, that money spent improving the lives of women and girls is the most effective path to improving lives in general, since they have the most untapped potential. In this issue, we spotlight a circle of influential women whom Melinda has mentored and supported in their desire to give back on multiple fronts, from Sarah Blakely's focus on fostering entrepreneurship to Anne Wojcicki's champion of scientist to Tsitsi Masiyiwa's commitment to education, food security, and disaster preparedness. Keziah also spoke with Melinda at length about her renewed philanthropic objectives, the experiences of sexism that helped inform her point of view, and her endorsement of Vice President Kamala Harris. On that note, this is the first editor's letter I'm writing since Harris stepped up and into the presidential race, energizing the Democratic Party and changing the course of the election. The unprecedented shakeup has made for an electric summer and fall in our newsroom as we follow the candidates and their diet Mountain Dew-loving vice presidential picks on the road to November 5th. I hope you're following our coverage on VF.com, from convention reporting to campaign analysis to meme and merch scorecards. Or is Tim Walz a Chapel Roan stan? And listening to our weekly politics podcast, Inside the Hive. We are committed to keeping you up to date through Election Day and beyond in the way only Vanity Fair can. Here are some of the contributors to the issue. Sebastian Kim, Give and Let Give. Melinda French Gates's only request was that we play the tortured poets department, says photographer Kim. Luckily, his daughter is a Swiftie, so he wasn't caught off guard. Aside from taking portraits and listening to Taylor Swift, he is learning how to cook Korean and Japanese dishes. Catherine Joyce, Bad Faith. Joyce is an investigative journalist, editor, and author who first wrote about the Catholic Rite for Vanity Fair in 2020. Back then, it was an overlooked part of American Christian nationalism that presaged the Church's impending civil war. In 2024, the story has gotten significantly weirder, she says. Ryan McAmis, Proust Questionnaire. Illustrator McAmis, who is building a scale model of a medieval cathedral in his free time, thinks sketching from interviews is the best way to capture a person's nuances. He had a great time combing through Stanley Tucci's videos, all while learning how to make spaghetti alla Nerano, he says. James Reginato, A House Divided. Tim Mellon has suddenly emerged as the most consequential megadonor of this election cycle, says Vanity Fair writer-at-large Reginato, who talked to Mellon's family and friends to learn more about the little-known member of the old money dynasty. Case Wickman, Stranger Things. It was fascinating to see how quickly Harris's campaign pivoted to this messaging after Biden stepped aside as nominee, proving that campaigns really aren't one-size-fits-all, says Wickman, a frequent Vanity Fair contributor and author. Mikhail Zygar, Party Planning. Zygar was the founding editor-in-chief of Russia's only independent TV channel, TV Rain, now in exile, and has authored three books on the country. Since relocating to New York in 2023, he is a visiting professor at Princeton University and writes The Last Pioneer, a newsletter about the Kremlin. Maisie Stella Knows How to Think Outside the Box by Anthony Bresnikan, with photographs of her wearing high-fashion looks by Daria Kobayashi-Rich. Maisie Stella didn't have a TV as a kid because her musician parents didn't want her and her older sister Lennon tuning in and tuning out. So the girls used their imaginations. My sister made a cardboard TV, a cardboard box TV, that I would get in, and she had a fake cardboard remote, Stella says. I'd do a baking show, and then she'd be like, soap opera, and I'd be like, you killed my husband. We would do that for hours. That was our entertainment. Only later, when the girls landed roles as Connie Britton's children on the country music drama Nashville, did their mother and father relent. We bought a TV the day that me and my sister got on TV. Now 20, Stella has broken through as the wry lead of the irresistible coming-of-age comedy My Old Ass, which Amazon MGM Studios bought after it beguiled audiences at the Sundance Film Festival early this year. The movie, in theaters September 13th, is about a teenage girl named Elliot who's eager to grow up and get away from her family's Lake Town cranberry farm until a dose of especially potent psychedelic shrooms triggers a Ghost of Christmas Future-style visit from her 39-year-old self, played by Aubrey Plaza. Older Elliot comes bearing wisdom and warnings about regrets to come. Most of it involves telling younger Elliot how to avoid heartbreaks and to appreciate the people in her life before they're gone. Some of it's more practical, like wear your retainer. Stella was born in Ontario and essentially grew up on camera during 6 seasons on Nashville, which she joined at the age of 8. The show featured many songs she wrote with her sister and propelled their YouTube channel to around 720,000 subscribers. In the years since, Stella has become an old hand at the ups and downs of Hollywood, making her reluctant to get too excited for a project that might fall apart or not go her way. When she read writer-director Megan Park's script for My Old Ass, however, she felt instant anxiety at the idea of not getting the role, especially since she'd heard 10,000 girls auditioned for it. I knew how bad I wanted it, and I knew how right it felt, Stella says. So I just went full on. I have a shitty tuna can boat, just like Elliot, and I sent the producers a video of me giving a tour of my boat. In the movie, Elliot has only ever fallen for other girls, but her unexpected yearning for a local guy, someone her older self warns her to stay away from, no matter what, complicates her sense of identity, leading to hilarious genre-tweaking conversations with her best friends, as well as her future self, about who she is and what she really wants. I know so many people that have had such similar experiences, Stella says. I think it's much less common to be sure of what you want. I mean, I've always been queer. I'm in a queer relationship. But I've always been open, and I've never been explicitly one thing. I've been given the space and the room to not put a label on myself. Now that the buzz around My Old Ass has raised her profile in Hollywood, Stella is plotting her next moves. I just want to keep making movies, and I want to keep making art, and I want to keep figuring my shit out, she says. I'm in a position right now where I'm being considered for things, which is earth-shattering to me. She's already shot a new film, the surreal drama Flowervale Street, with Anne Hathaway and Ewan McGregor playing her parents. They were truly beyond lovely, both of them, she says. Ewan is the coolest that's ever lived, and Annie has such a gentle power about her that I was so moved by. Stella will be the one wowing newcomers someday. It's the whole point of My Old Ass. She's got a future. Fashion Plate by Daisy Shaw Ellis, with photograph by Vanessa Granda, showing a Prada bag along with blue and white china dishes and a figurine. Redolent of fine china, this petite Prada handbag features textured florals, little reliefs made in spatulato, brushed calfskin leather, that mimic the effect of hand-painted porcelain. Inspired by delicate tableware, the dainty hard-bodied bag is a true pocketbook. Keys or a tube of lipstick will fit, a phone not so much. No need for any of that, because it's pretty enough for the curio cabinet. Here's what's trending. Meet cute. From When Harry Met Sally to You've Got Mail, Nora Ephron's singular style championed the feminist perspective in witty banter and chunky knits. Nora Ephron at the Movies, published by Abrams, explores her life, legacy, and reinvention of the rom-com. In the photo, Meg Ryan and Billy Crystal in a scene from When Harry Met Sally, featured in the monograph Nora Ephron at the Movies by Ilana Kaplan. Bewitched, Hourglass Cosmetics Liquid Blush and Craft, Pandora Bracelet, Laurel Piana Pants, Aesop Aliosband Balm, Hand Balm, God's True Cashmere Shirt, Miu Miu Shoes, Thoreau Sweater, Rag and Bone Jeans, Prada Sweater, Muscat Eyeglasses, Vince Skirt, Dries Van Noten Sneakers, Hermes Baronia Eau de Parfum Berluti Jacket, Nora Ephron at the Movies by Ilana Kaplan, and Rolex Watch. Now on to books. Past Perfect, a new collection of photography, presents a glittering jet set, but serves too as a moving meditation on the passage of time, with photographs by Jonathan Becker, article by David Friend. In the photos, Fran Lebowitz at the 2000 Vanity Fair Oscar Party, Brooke Del Campo 2005, Jonathan Becker's self-portrait 1977, last time, Ernest Hemingway's Idaho Home, 2011. In the early 1980s, Vanity Fair, after a 47-year hiatus, was planning to relaunch. To help fill the pages, art director B. Feitler turned to a trusted protege, a 26-year-old photographer with a hungry eye and a devilish grin. His name was Jonathan Becker. Recently, he'd been driving a cab. To scrape by, he'd relied on free dinners from his pal Elaine Kaufman, proprietor of the legendary Upper East Side Boite Elaine's. Even so, Feitler saw promise in the kid, as she called him. And in 1983, when Vanity Fair took flight, Becker was on board. His beat became New York's corridors of power. Its literary circles, its socialites, and swans. Before long, he'd be jetting off to Buenos Aires and Captain Teeb, applying the wisdom he'd gleaned from mentors like Brassai, Jean-Paul Goud, and Slim Ahrens. Always stylish and a devotee of fine design, Becker would become a denizen of the beau monde he photographed. Some 40 years on, he continues to make masterly portraits, collaborating with his subjects to achieve, as he puts it, an almost intimate mutual understanding. This month, Phaidon publishes Jonathan Becker, Lost Time, edited by Mark Holborn. A companion exhibition runs at the Katona Museum of Art through January. The book, a photo memoir of Becker's charmed life and work, is a shrewdly paced gallery of royals, rogues, and statesmen. Artist and newsmakers, pruned gardens and perfect interiors, and above all, individuals of impeccable taste. Holborn's poignant juxtapositions and time shifts reinforce the sublime melancholy of the passage of seasons, years, decades. Becker's lens is a Proustian hourglass in which each grain is a gleam of light that flashes, then lingers, then fades. Indeed, lost time seems to rescue memory itself from oblivion. And this from Keziah Weir, six-pack, gripping inquiries into all aspects of humanity. And the roots of rhythm remain. Producer Joe Boyd, Nick Drake, REM, follows roving threads of sound. Brass in Istanbul, Cuban jam sessions, Congolese rumba, and the artists they influenced from Bob Marley to David Byrne. Published by Z Books. Abortion. Since the fall of Roe, Jessica Valenti has tracked the state of reproductive rights, from local bans to ballot measures. Ahead of a pivotal election, she lays out the landscape, presenting a cogent case that bodily autonomy wins votes. Published by Crown. An image of my name enters America. From the expansive mind of novelist, poet, and critic Lucy Ives, stylish, sweeping essays that consider the lure of period rooms. Alanis Morissette, Heidegger, and more. Published by Grey Wolf. No Road Leading Back. Vanity Fair contributor Chris Heath traces the harrowing accounts of 12 Jewish prisoners who escaped the Holocaust killing site at Ponar, Lithuania, as well as those of bystanders in this investigation of truth and silence. Published by Shokin. Recognizing the Stranger, this succinct and thorough study of humanism and turning points collects novelist Isabella Hammond's Edward W. Said Memorial Lecture on Palestine, delivered in September 2023, and a substantial afterword written this year, published by Black Cat. By the Fire We Carry, Rebecca Nagel, a Cherokee journalist, examines the thorny history of a murder case that ballooned into a question of tribal land rights in a narrative as propulsive and affecting as it is infuriating. Published by Harper.
Thank you.
Haute Gossip, Lainey Louie, creator of celebrity news devotional Lainey Gossip, swears by espresso martinis and her mom's vintage Rolexes while keeping tabs on the A-list. Style file, daily uniform, fried rice t-shirt, frappois jeans. Beloved brand, Johnny. Go-to shoe, the Mrs. Maisel mid-heel by the office of Angela Scott. Earrings, Maria Tash handcuff in white gold. Wrist candy, Rolexes from my mother's vault. Style icons, Michelle Yeoh and Rina Sawayama. Self-care, face wash, Dermalogica special cleansing gel, serum, skin cuticle CE Ferulic. Moisturizers, Road Barrier Restore Cream during the day and Shiseido Vital Perfection Uplifting and Firming Cream enriched at night. Makeup routine, Shiseido Sports BB Cream, Dior Forever Skin Correct Concealer, Sephora Collection Charged Up Liquid Eyeshadow, Sunny's Face Fluff Matte Lipstick, and Nature Republic Essential Lip Balm. Hair care, RYO Damage Care, and Nourishing Shampoo and Conditioner, and a wet brush. Perfume, Maison Margiela Replica Matcha Meditation. Workout, golf, wearing Peretti. At home, recent addition, an air fryer. The unexpected, our marital annual golf trophy. Houseplants, money trees. Dinnerware, Denby pasta bowls are my favorite. Art, a commissioned portrait of Beyoncé. Furry friends, two beagles, Barney and Elvis. For pleasure, reading How to End a Love Story by Yulin Kwang. Watching Chinese and Korean dramas. Listening to Beyoncé and Ray, inspired by Chinese beauty influencers on TikTok. The menu, morning cup, hot water, indulgent beverage, and espresso martini. Power snack, Jack Link's beef jerky. Home-cooked specialty, beef and tomato stewy rice, Hong Kong diner style. Takeout order, ravioli du Dauphiné from Café René in Toronto. Clutch Lit. Style and substance abound in this selection of smart bags and great fiction. Befitting the season, some are scary, but all are scary good. With photograph of the books and bags by Josephine Sheila. Model Home. In River Solomon's haunting drama, Esri and their sisters return to their parents' house in the gated Dallas community where they were the only black family and where an agonizing truth about the past awaits. Published by MCD. And the bag, Bottega Veneta Libertà bag. A Reason to See You Again, from Jamie Attenberg, doyen of absorbing family excavations, 37 years in the life of the Coens. A closeted patriarch, his foundering widow, their daughters, poles apart. Published by Echo. The bag, the Roe Mini Devon bag. Rejection, obsessively readable, acerbic, Foster Wallace inflected, in seven linked stories, Toni Tuleth-Mitty's characters, feminist incel, zealous startup guy, spurned woman, rejected author, Fail to Connect. Published by William Morrow. The bag? Kite, the Kate handbag. Intermezzo, a chess prodigy in his early 20s, and his brother, a 30-something lawyer, navigate various relationships, their own thorny one, plus complicated romances, and Sally Rooney's compelling latest, published by FSG. The bag, Chanel Vanity Case. The Mighty Red. Louise Erdrich sets her rich saga against the backdrop of the 2008 economic crash in North Dakota, where the teenage daughter of a woman trucker is set to marry a farming heir while wooed by another man, published by Harper. The bag, Ferragamo, Fiamma crossbody bag. In the Distance, published in paperback by the Indie Coffee House Press in 2017, Hernan Diaz's best in show of an underdog debut, a surreal western about a Swede's adventures, appears in hardcover for the first time, published by Riverhead. The bag, Fendi, Peekaboo soft handbag. Blood Test. In an Ohio town beset by opioids, an insurance salesman learns that he's genetically predisposed to violent crime, and to hilarious effect, finds himself barreling down a deadly path to Charles Baxter's Tinder Tale, published by Pantheon. In the bag, Mew Mew, Arcady bag. The Impusium, Olga Tokarczuk's health resort horror story, finds a young tuberculosis sufferer seeking treatment in the Silesian Mountains, where questions of gender, class, and mysterious murders arise, published by Riverhead. And the bag, Chloe Bracelet bag. The books were synopsized by Keziah Weir.
Thank you.
Narrative Arch. In a new architecture monograph, glossy brownstone renovations and modern masterpieces come alive through an unusual inhabitant, Flash Fiction, by Keziah Weir. In the photos, one of Elizabeth Roberts's revamped Brooklyn brownstones, a vintage postcard from a Roscoe, New York lake, the living room of the Roscoe Mountain House, stacked stones inside and out. When architect Elizabeth Roberts has a creative block, it's usually just a sign she hasn't collected enough information yet. For the California transplant, made famous by her airy overhauls of New York townhouses, Maggie Gyllenhaal and Peter Sarsgaard's Park Slope brownstone, and Athena Calderon's Cobble Hill Greek Revival among them, this might mean the neighborhood's history, or how the rising sun hits a building. Such was the case, too, when the owners of a plot sprawling over a Catskills hilltop invited her to submit a proposal. The possibilities initially proved stifling. The home, she says, could be anything. But in considering the space, I realized that these stacked stone walls all over the property told me where the house wanted to be. They served not only as a guide, but also as the building's structure and a crucial design element. After hundreds of years and understanding the grade and the light and the views, these farmers nailed it. Roberts has captured this layered process in her first monograph, Collected Stories, published by Monticelli, which she co-wrote with Alana Stang and which chronicles projects ranging from that mountain house to Rachel Comey's Soho flagship. I love doing bright, open, glossy, gorgeous things beside dusty, ornate things, she says, a natural amalgamation, perhaps, of the wide open spaces of her Marin County childhood and the New York City grit and history that won her adult heart. Likewise, in the book, sleek images of a travertine-clad bathroom, preserved crown moldings, and her signature white walls, Benjamin Moore's mellow cloud white in pristine historic restorations and new builds, Chantilly lace to brighten a basement apartment or the walls of her own architecture firm. Live alongside loose sketches and ephemera, a vintage postcard from an upstate lake, a Brooklyn map circa 1766. But what breathed life into the book for Roberts was the infusion of Flash Fiction by Christine Colson, the veteran of more than 25 years of the Metropolitan Museum of Art, whose Metropolitan Stories, 2019, Imagine Sentient Artworks, and One Woman Show, 2023, described a human life through museum wall labels. Colson may share Roberts' appreciation for white space, at least in her windowless writing studio, lit by skylights, but their methods are practically inverse. Colson asked Roberts to send photos sans context, free-associating pithy scenes, surreal and moving, the end of a relationship from an image of an historic bell, teens fencing upstairs, prompted by a lofty entrance hall. The stone had pushed itself up through the floor, Colson writes, in response to the huge marble kitchen island of an Italianate townhouse, like a gentle beast, offering the ridge of its back for utilitarian use. She has a wry eye for human peculiarities. It's interesting, our desire to move giant pieces of earth and rock into our homes at great expense. The vignettes are a metaphor for what architects have to do all the time, Colson says. They build these beautiful places, and then they have to let people live in them. In some ways, these stories are me living in Elizabeth's work. in upcoming installments. We'll read about an alt-tech universe, as well as Selena Gomez, that and more in upcoming installments. This program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. I'm Nancy Jones, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service and broadcasting from its studios in Raleigh, North Carolina. Vanity Fair Part A airs via special subchannel receiver on Saturday and Sunday nights at 11 o'clock. Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Vanity Fair Part B airs via special subchannel receiver on Monday and Tuesday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Both Parts A and B are available as a podcast. Opening and closing music by Calexico. Interval selections by Mark Hoffman.